Yesterday marked the 1,000th day since the U.S. invaded Iraq, and beginning with the war itself, a war crime, one might call it 1,000 days of war crimes. At the moment, the focus of international attention is on the torture of prisoners, secret CIA prisons in Eastern Europe. Would you have been trying to call attention to a crime, Karen Parker, that has been largely neglected, the attack on Iraqi medical facilities? So you have been working for the UN as a legal advisor. You have been connected, working for war crimes on war crimes issues for so many years. It must be frustrating at this point when we spoke briefly about the issue of the medical facilities that were attacked.
Yes.
And there's been almost no attention paid to that.
Right. This is particularly frustrating, Jeff, because protection of hospitals and medical facilities was actually the original purpose of the Geneva Conventions, and subsequently expanded both protections for hospitals, ambulances, etc., and then got into other areas such as prohibiting certain kinds of weapons, which we're also using in Iraq, and getting into issues such as protection of victims and military operations, and of course, addressing torture. But one of the reasons I'm so upset about the relative silence around the hospital attack issue is because those attacks actually are you might just call it a frontal assault on the Geneva Conventions themselves. The United States shows no remorse, does no apology, and isn't even challenged on it locally here in the United States, whereas abroad, of course, people are very shocked about it. The head of the British Red Cross said it may be the death knell for the Geneva Conventions. And the United Nations expert human rights body adopted a resolution condemning it.
Well, it's interesting. When they went into Fallujah for the second invasion and they targeted the hospital, they said they were going to the hospital because the hospital was the source of the misinformation that had been circulated about so-called U.S. war crimes during the first Fallujah attack.
Well, whatever excuse the United States tries to give, hospitals are off limits. To attack them is a war crime. Because of that attack, the second attack on Fallujah Hospital in November last year, I filed a legal action at the Organization of American States against the United States for this kind of war crime. It's just absolutely inexcusable that this kind of action would go on without a hue and cry, without lawsuits, without at least trying to educate people and realize the young men and women who participated can have this hanging over their head for years and years and years. Again, it's an extremely serious issue. If we don't have the Geneva Conventions at all, we are in bad shape. Our own soldiers are at risk. And then we go in and attack hospitals with illegal weapons, weapons with depleted uranium, white phosphorus called shake and bake, cluster bombs. This is really horrible. At least with the torture issue, as bad as it is, the United States has tried to pretend that torture isn't our policy. Now, it may be bald-faced lying, but nobody is saying attacking hospitals isn't our policy. And that's what's really, really bad and very, very frustrating.
Well, it's interesting that we know that, at least since World War II and the updated conventions, that the United States has been violating them. We know that in Vietnam, but it's always been undercover in a sense. And now, I had quoted earlier in my introduction some parts of Harold Pinter's speech to the Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm.
The fact the United States now no longer really cares that much, and when it makes a denial, it's almost saying, if you don't like what we're saying, too bad.
Right. I think what is most disturbing is the idea of impunity. All countries violate human rights, and all countries at war violate the Geneva Conventions, the Hague Conventions, etc. But to be so overt, so blatant, and so catch me if you can, but you can't, ha-ha, it's that attitude that's extremely serious. Countries try to comply with human rights, not all. And warring parties try to comply with the Geneva Conventions, not all, and not always successfully. But I think if the United States were attacked, if our medical facilities in Iraq were attacked, it would be headline news war crimes, and the United States would be demanding that the insurgents in Iraq be captured and tried for war crimes, and yet won't apply the same standard to themselves. I think this has been my tone all along, and I think it's also Harold Pinter's tone and what he was saying. You know, if we can't stop the rogue elephants, what do we do? And I say it's not just a rogue elephant. It's a whole herd of rogue elephants, and we're being trampled. The rules are being trampled. Our constitution's being trampled, and our young men and women that we're sending to Iraq are being turned into war criminals.
Well, at least they won't get prosecuted by international criminal court. I remember in 1998 when Bill Clinton was the president and I was in Rome, they were having a debate at the Food and Agricultural Organization, UN office headquarters, to implement the new international criminal court. And even though the writers of the document made many concessions at the urging of the United States, in order to get the United States to even participate, the United States only signed it and never approved it. And now, of course, President Bush has taken the signature off, and we have been signing and forcing countries to sign bilateral agreements that they would not prosecute U.S. officials or soldiers. This seems to be something the general public doesn't really know, but it's like a finger in the eye or in the middle finger to the rest of the world.
Yes, that is. But one of the important aspects of the Geneva Conventions is that the Geneva Conventions require all signatory states, and that basically includes every country on Earth, to seek out and try violators of the Geneva Conventions. Now, the United States has tried to get countries such as Germany and France and Italy and some of the Latin American countries where the possibility of such tribunals might take place, they've tried to get those states to sign bilateral agreements that, although there is this provision in the Geneva Convention, the countries won't implement it as a sort of a backup to not having agreements that nobody could be brought to the criminal court. People can't be brought to the criminal court because the United States isn't a signatory party. But every high contracting party, every signatory of the Geneva Conventions can seek out and try violators at all levels of the violation, from the soldier on the street to the general in the office who provided the order or the cover for war crimes. The other aspect that I think American people don't realize is under the Nuremberg Tribunal, the statute that was created for that allowed for those defending war crimes. I don't mean an attorney in a case with somebody who's tried, but those that are trying to provide the sort of legal arguments why it's okay ahead of the fact or during the fact, they can also be prosecuted. Now, there are a lot of people involved in the planning and execution of our policies in Iraq, including the management of the war, a lot of attorneys in the Justice Department twisting and turning international law so that, you know, there is this aura that everything we do is somehow legal and okay, or it's in a gray area when it's not. These people also have a lifetime looking at the possibility of tribunals. Now, one of the problems is with some of these bilateral agreements, the attorneys in those countries have to first challenge those agreements as being in contravention of their own domestic law before they could actually then open up and have a trial. And the Bush administration people are extremely expert in creating so many legal barriers. And I think knowing that the people who can challenge them, such as me and my organization or the ACLU or comparable organizations in other countries, simply don't have the money to undertake all the extensive legal challenges that need to be made. Just look at all the atrocities, the human rights atrocities in the Patriot Act. I mean, it would take 20 ACLU's fully funded to even scratch the surface. So they've bankrupted us. I have no money to even continue to pursue the Organization of American States case against the United States for attacking the hospitals in Fallujah. The American people are maybe they're intimidated. They don't know, they don't know how many legal barriers are there. But we're in an extremely, extremely serious situation.
Well, we're just about to go into the half a trillion dollar expenses for the war in Iraq. It was announced this morning with an extra request for $100 billion more for the war on top of $50 billion about to be passed.
Yes. But you have to remember, Jeff, that we're also liable for all the war damage. We have to rebuild those hospitals. We attacked them and destroyed them in contravention of existing law. So it's not just that we have to pay for the bullets and the napalm and the cluster bombs and the shake-and-bake white phosphorus and the illegal depleted uranium weapons. We have to pay. We have to rebuild Iraq. It's in our pocket. We can't take their oil resources and then use it for our debts. This is grotesque.
We know about what happened to the hospital in Fallujah, but the U.S. military, through its Air Force as well as the soldiers on the ground, but the Air Force have been attacking virtually all the cities, some in villages and towns on the Syrian border by air, destroying civilian facilities. Are you aware of all? Have you been able to find out at all, because the media is not embedded there, of hospitals and medical facilities destroyed in any other Iraqi towns?
Oh, yes. My lawsuit at the Organization of American States is right now limited to the Fallujah question, because the Organization of American States is going to have to address the legal issue of whether or not they can an action can be brought in the inter-American system against a member of the inter-American system for an event that occurs outside the inter-American system. Now, in the comparable European court, that issue has been decided, and favorably, it would be favorably to the Fallujah case. So I wanted to at least focus on Fallujah because it was so clear-cut and it asked the question, but I'm very aware of all these other attacks on hospitals throughout Iraq. It wasn't just an accident in Fallujah. It's a policy. And one of the first facilities targeted in many, many, many towns are the hospitals. So there's an enormous toll on the medical infrastructure. And it's even so bad that when doctors from the areas have gone out away trying to bring in emergency medical equipment and bring them back in a vehicle with the Red Cross on it or an ambulance, they get targeted as well.
Well, they were prevented from entering Fallujah, as I recall.
In Fallujah, the Iraqi Red Crescent was prohibited for quite some time. Now they're able to be there in very limited circumstances. They haven't been allowed into other areas. Part of it is because the attacks on the medical infrastructure, the war crimes, are so obvious. They want as few a witness as possible, especially people who would know a war crime when they see one, which is what the Red Crescent would be able to do. What is also so horrible is that the photograph of the United States troops attacking Fallujah General Hospital was on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle. So the American people and the people here in California were presented with a photograph of a war crime taking place. Not one of our legislators here in California said anything. And with information about subsequent hospitals, it is the most deafening silence I've ever heard. This is really awful. It's not, whoops, we made a mistake. It's, this is our policy. We're doing it. We're doing it every day. And we're going to use those uranium weapons no matter what you say.
My guest is Karen Parker, who is international legal expert on war crimes and human rights. This is a dilemma for us because we have both political parties supported this war. And even now, they talk about maybe a timetable withdrawal dates on the part of the Democrats, but the issue of war crimes has not been discussed at all.
Right. And we have an obligation as Americans to make sure that our legislators are aware of it and that, and carry out proper remedial actions, both legal and financial. What is so surprising is that because of the gravity of the attacks on the hospitals and major war crimes, this is an impeachable offense. You know, our Democrats are sitting on clear-cut impeachable defense. Maybe Bush thinks he has wiggle room in the torture. Oh, I didn't really know it. It wasn't really our policy. People are mistaken, and they try to argue away on the facts, and then people don't know for sure. Even now, the Council of Europe investigators is looking into the Eastern European countries being used as torture facilities, but it hasn't been proven. You know what I mean? It's a fact argument. There's no fact argument for the torture. I mean, for the hospitals. There's no fact argument.
One of the things that's interesting is under the first George Bush administration, Congressman Henry Gonzalez put in an impeachment amendment against the first president, George Bush. This president's father committed his own war crimes, but nothing like the son, and yet not a single member of Congress has been willing to put their name on an impeachment resolution, even though every week it seems there is a new good reason to do so.
A new impeachable offense, sir.
Yes.
I mean, if you just use Fallujah General Hospital, that's enough, you know? And then you add on it the clinics, the ambulances, the doctors killed, the patients killed. Then you go to the next town and that hospital and the next town and that hospital. And then you have the fact that the United States is using illegal weapons with depleted uranium that the United Nations expert body on human rights have found illegal. And the Pentagon tries to argue around it saying it's not really illegal, there's no treaty. Well, there doesn't have to be a treaty. You know, you can't use a weapon that does that, what depleted uranium does. You can't use a weapon that makes children of U.S. soldiers born with no arms and legs. You know, you just... And the rubber language is so intense. Once again, Nuremberg said, the Nuremberg Tribunal process set up a system where people who were advocating the wiggle room are also chargeable. We have a lot of people trying to argue wiggle room for Bush or maintaining silence when they're in a position and they're duty-bound by our Constitution to speak up. We're in a very, very serious situation.
It's interesting. I believe it's apparent that there are people in what I call the mainstream establishment who are very concerned at the appearances of what Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld are doing, because I remember several weeks ago there was an amazing ad in the New York Times which showed a person with a bandana over his eyes and a statement on the torture is not an American value. And I expected it to be signed by the ACLU or People for the American Way. And what names were on it but the names of former Secretaries of State, Ambassadors, Madeleine Albright, James Baker, Howard Baker, and including the infamous Thomas Pickering.
Yes, I remember Thomas Pickering.
Yeah, and it's obvious that, of course, going back to Vietnam and the Phoenix program, and we don't have to go into details of that, but the U.S. and other countries who occupy and invade other countries do commit torture, and it was notorious in Vietnam, but it wasn't talked about. It wasn't defended publicly like Cheney seems to be out of control. Rumsfeld, these people are trying to rationalize it in the public print, and this has not gone over well around the world.
Oh, no. Outside of the United States, there's just horror at how to stop this. Whereas inside the United States, everyone is feeling kind of helpless. I do think there are remedies. I'm very, very disappointed that the people that signed that statement in the New York Times did not include the attacks on hospitals. For the life of me, I cannot imagine why the American Red Cross did not say anything. The British Red Cross, the International Committee of the Red Cross, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the United Nations Secretary General, and countless international law experts, both inside and outside international forums, spoke up about it. We didn't have one.
Well, the American Red Cross has a very checkered record Over the years, people contribute money to it. It's placed the first place you're supposed to send money when there's some kind of a disaster. But the record has not been very good. It was not very good in Katrina.
No.
Where money went down there, but people down in New Orleans didn't see anything. Didn't see any of it. And didn't see
right.
the Red Cross helping them. And then the Red Cross comes up with this argument that they cannot publicly make statements because that will interfere with their access to prisoners. But the United States has denied them access to prisoners in many cases.
Right. Well, you know how bad it is when the head of the International Red Cross in Switzerland and the head of the British Red Cross actually do speak out. There is a kind of tone of confidentiality with the International Committee of the Red Cross because they do want access to people. So unless things are really bad, they tend to say, well, the best we can do is help who we can help. If we speak out, we're going to be thrown out. But it's so bad. What the U.S. was doing against the hospital was so bad, they were speaking out. Why didn't the American Red Cross isn't in Iraq. The American Red Cross knows the rules. They could have said something.
And they're
familiar,
right.
We have members
right.
of Congress that are doctors. They should have been appalled.
Bill Frist is a doctor.
Actually, I have to defend Representative Jim McDermott from the state of Washington. He's a medical doctor. He was appalled. He got a group of doctors in the Washington area. They wrote an op-ed piece, which was published in the Seattle, I think it's Times Intelligencer.
Post-Intelligencer, yeah.
Yeah, Post-Intelligencer. And as far as I know, other than a Canadian doctor writing an article about that included mention of my lawsuit, those are the only things in the only pieces in the North American major media about attacks on hospitals. Although in the rest of the world, it's all over the place. And you can imagine what it was like in Switzerland.
Well, given the unpopularity of the resident of the White House in Latin America, what's the possibility of the Organization of American States, which has rebuffed him on a number of occasions dealing
yep.
with economic issues, what's the chance of that case going through?
Well, I think there's a good chance. I think the jurisdiction question is going to be sticky for them. They don't want to open the floodgates, so to speak, because the United States does so much bad in other countries as well outside of the area. It's also encouraging that some of the countries that refused these bilateral agreements to not sue the United States are in Latin America, and they were holding the line. The United States was threatening them with cutting off all aid and all kinds of other penalties if they wouldn't sign the bilateral agreements, but a number of countries did not sign. And then the member states defied the United States in choosing a successor Secretary General of the Organization of American States. So I think there is a realization at the Organization of American States, a political realization, that if they are a serious organization and have any kind of future, they have to get out from under the thumb of the United States. And this is what's happening. My petition, my lawsuit in the Organization of American States, Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, hits at a time when huge questions are being asked in Latin America about the role of the United States outside its own territory. So I'm optimistic. I can't promise. My guess is even if they decline jurisdiction, they will still write a scathing condemnation of the acts. So there can be at least certain things salvaged. And, of course, that kind of scathing indictment of the acts can encourage the other Latin American countries to use the provisions of the Geneva Conventions to seek out and try violators in their countries.
Well, let's hope that happens. We have a first caller on the air. Your number here, by the way, is 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117. Let's go to the first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Jeffrey. It's Burton.
Hi, Burton.
I'm thinking from the sounds of what I hear that the sounds of bombs falling on infrastructure, especially delicate things like hospitals and water treatment facilities mm-hmm. and such, at the corporate headquarters of Halliburton and Bechtel and such, they're the sounds of cash registers opening.
Yes, actually, there are lawyers in Europe that are seeking to file lawsuits in European courts against some of the providers of the illegal weapons and the illegal activity and those who are participating in illegal activities using both the Nuremberg and Geneva Convention type jurisdiction, which does go beyond people who are actually military personnel. If you're acting under the authority of military personnel, you can be tried. These actions are being put together. Funds are trying to be raised to deal with that. As you probably are aware, Burton, our side doesn't, we don't have the money. We have the law. They have the money. They have lawlessness. So we're in a big dilemma.
And then at the top end of our leadership, and I use the word casually, we have people that are obviously motivated by other than the law and more like the coffers, the cash
right.
coffers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the whys and wherefores in Iraq, it had nothing to do with the Iraqi people or care and love for the Iraqi people and trying to free them from an admitted tyrant. It had nothing to do with that. Still doesn't.
Yeah. Thank you for your work.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's interesting, this morning on National Public Radio, they interviewed Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute and the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which was started by the Israeli lobby AIPAC. And he was saying the Iraqi people think this war is about oil, but they don't realize we were trying to free them. Here's another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted, for those of us who aren't completely suffering from Alzheimer's, I just think of the awesome irony that kind of trigger that actually made the Congress approve going into the first Gulf War was the false story of the Kuwaitis invading the hospital and taking the incubators, and this whole phony story put out by the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter, who wasn't even there, and the fact that was the trigger that made the U.S. public and Congress, you know, gung-ho about, oh, we have to go out there and get Saddam for doing this horrible thing, and here we are doing the same thing, and oh, it's okay if we do it.
Yeah, American people tend to forget really, really quickly, but we can't afford to do that, not in this light. Yes, we are doing the same things we said Iraq was doing in Kuwait. We're also using food and water as weapons of war. We're depriving people of access to food and water. We're destroying their water system. We're doing stuff that's twice as bad as even the allegations back then, which were probably inflated. So we have to remember, of course, that whole sanctions regime was a fraud and a violation in itself. And how the American people could possibly have thought after 11, 12, 13 years of sanctions, during which they couldn't even buy pencils with graphite in them for school children and had been completely disarmed, how they can possibly be a threat to the United States is totally beyond belief.
And particularly when the British and U.S. had illegal no-fly zones in the north and the south, and obviously were observing and photographing what was going on in Iraq.
We were also bombing daily in the no-fly zone.
Right, thousands of tons of bombs.
We actually were at war with Iraq in the low no-fly zones for years before we officially invaded.
Exactly. We have a couple of callers here. Let's go to one here. Hello, you're on the air.
Thank you. Who's the guest representing? What group?
Oh, Karen Parker, you're with the Human Rights.
Oh,
yes.
I filed the petition at the Organization of American States on behalf of the Association of Humanitarian Lawyers.
Okay.
An association that's desperately in need of funds to continue the lawsuit. It was filed on behalf of the unnamed, unnumbered victims, both living and dead, in the facilities.
How do people reach you?
Well, contributions to the Association of Humanitarian Lawyers can be sent to 154 Fifth Avenue, San Francisco, 94118. My personal telephone, I'm happy to give that number out, is area code 419 1-5-668-2752. That's my office. Excuse me, I meant to say office telephone. That's my office telephone.
And you have a website as well?
There's a website, www.humanlaw.org.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll follow up on this.
Thank you very much, caller.
I'll call later.
Thanks very much. And we have another caller here. Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. This is John Llewellyn. I've been working for several years on the problem of the use of uranium munitions, usually called depleted uranium. Now it looks like a gigantic global health crisis to me of breathable uranium oxides saturating environments in unpredictable areas, and a problem that needs to be exposed but is being totally covered up. How do you think we can move forward on this problem?
Well, thank you so much for bringing up depleted uranium munitions, because I've been working on that issue since 1996 when I first heard about it. In 1996, I got the United Nations expert body to declare depleted uranium weapons illegal. They repeated that in 1997. The United Nations Secretary General submitted a report to the expert body on the issue. I've written on this issue. We got the United Nations to approve an expert study. I worked very closely with the expert on two studies, one in 2002, one in 2003. I've tried desperately to get the American groups who are working on the depleted uranium munitions issue to take this argument, the international documents and legal theories about why depleted uranium is illegal, and pass that around, have that be the gist of their discussions with their legislators, etc. So far, it's a spotty success, without funds to travel around and go to events. It's very difficult, but I have been to several events, international events, on the depleted uranium issue. Some of the United States groups who are working on depleted uranium issue don't seem to be interested in the fact that depleted uranium weapons are illegal, and we're using weapons of mass destruction and illegal weapons in Iraq, but that is my main focus. They are illegal precisely because of what you are talking about. They're illegal because of what they do to the environment, what they do to people. They're poisoning all of us. Our Gulf War vets, both one and two, are having serious uranium-related illnesses. Our VA, our Veterans Administration, people are trying to deny coverage. They're trying to deny they're injured. They're lacking, you know, so these vets don't have what they need to treat their situation. Their children are being born with disabilities that are related to low-grade radiation, and there's total denial in the military.
And we could imagine whatever happens in Iraq, whatever the political situation, however it falls out, the fallout of this depleted uranium is going to affect everybody.
Right. The conservative estimates right now are that of the Gulf War I vets, approaching 40% have from a rather debilitating to a total disability. These are young men and young women in the prime of life. Unheard of to have that kind of medical fallout.
Our board is lit up. I'm going to get to another call right now. Thank you very much for calling, and thanks for that answer, Karen.
You're welcome.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering if you support the troops, are you complicit in war crimes, and what level of support of the troops does it cross the line into complicity of war crimes?
Supporting troops, supporting our young men and women, wanting to keep them alive, well, healthy,
is not a war crime. Supporting people, not troops.
Is not a war crime. Wanting to bring them home is not a war crime. If we close our eyes to what they're being ordered to do, we're kind of complicit.
Well, when you bring them home, maybe they just run around in black pickup trucks with guns in your neighborhood, like out here.
Obviously, when you're training people to commit war crimes at the level of gravity that they're being ordered to do, there is a long rehabilitation process that needs to occur before we would feel normally safe in our communities. There's always negative fallout from war crimes outside of the actual battlefield. It's what it does to the soldiers, and we are tainting our young men and women. And it's going to take a kind of rehabilitation system that I don't think people are prepared to even contemplate.
Well, yeah, I think most important thing is to make troops into people, and that means getting rid of people just following orders. Thank you for your work.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And thank you, Colin. And I want to thank you very much, Karen. We still have calls, but we're coming down to the end of the hour. And I want to thank you, Karen. Once again, I'd like you to give the information on how people can contact you and get involved with this very important work, because people are frustrated. They see this war going on. They see war crimes being committed, don't know what to do. You are doing something. How can people help you?
My phone number, once again, area code 415-668-2752. My website is humanlaw.org. The address for sending checks, which is the most important need right now, 154 Fifth Avenue, San Francisco, 94118.
And how should the checks be made out?
Checks could be made out either to me, or they could be made out to Association of Humanitarian Lawyers.
Again, I want to thank you for being my guest today. You had we had a lot of callers. Thank you all for those folks who called in, and keep up your great work, Karen. You've been doing it for a long time. It's a tough area to work, particularly it's like pushing something. It's pushing the ball uphill.
Yes. But you know,
the mountain uphill, yes.
We get little victories every day, so people do need to know that something can happen. It's not going to be huge tomorrow, but it's a step every day, and that's the only way we can work.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're entirely welcome.
Bye-bye.